Today's program was brought to you by craftbeer.com, dedicated to small and independent U.S. craft brewers. For more information, visit craftbeer.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening and welcome to Femen About It. I'm Mary Izette, one of your co-hosts, and I'd like to introduce a special episode of Femen About It tonight. Recently, I had the pleasure of moderating a panel of New York State brewers during New York City Beer Week at The Well in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We're going to play that for you tonight. A huge thanks to The Well and especially Josh, Ian, and Kanan for hosting the panel and recording it for us. Here we go. Hey. All right. So welcome to the next panel in craft brewing at The Well. My name is Mary Izette. I am an author, writer, brewer, and co-host of a weekly podcast called Femen About It. We started with beer and now do all things fermented. So I am super excited to be here hosting this panel or moderating this panel. Let me introduce you to the panel. So first off, we have Dan Acosta of LIC Beer Project. Next up is Eric Olson from Greenpoint. And then we're joined by Peter Oates and Ricardo Petroni of Equilibrium. So our kind of general overall theme for the panel is innovations in brewing. I've been a beer writer for over 10 years in New York City. And we've seen a lot of changes in craft brewing. First of all, 10 years ago, I think we had 3 breweries in all of New York City, maybe 4. And currently we're sitting at, what, 27, 28? 30 in New York City and a whole 31 and a whole heck of a lot in New York State. New York State is in top 5 in the country for number of breweries. I meant to look up the exact number. And we now have more breweries in this country than we ever have. We finally topped our pre-prohibition number last year. So it's a super exciting time to be in the industry, to be a brewer, and even more exciting time to be a craft beer drinker or a beer drinker.
We're spoiled.
Yes, we are spoiled. All right, so let's start. I'm going to have you guys introduce yourselves. So I'd love to hear how you got started in brewing and how you made the transition to professional brewing.
Thank you for having me. My name is Daniel Acosta. I'm with the LIC Beer Project. I got into the brewing industry about 12 years ago. I was spending time over in Europe, fell in love with Belgian ales. At the time, I was working as a project director for a large construction company here in New York City. So I landed a few jobs at some big breweries, doing build-outs and helping land equipment. And then I went back to school, got a degree in fermentation science, and set my sights on opening up a brewery like 5 years ago. And then here I am, rocking out.
I'm Eric from Greenpoint Beer. I got my start I grew up with a father. He was a home brewer, so I grew up with that most of my life. Started home brewing myself. Became an architect and decided I didn't want to be an architect. And got a job at a craft beer store called Browery Lane about 8 years ago. Managed Browery Lane for about 5 years and then jumped on board when Greenpoint got started about 3 years ago. So I started as assistant brewer and then moved up to head brewer.
My name's Peter Oates, and I got into brewing because of him, 100%. It's his fault. I'm a scientist by training. I got my doctorate from MIT doing a lot of work where I met Ricardo on trying to meet the Hudson River and kind of started falling in love with the Vermont beer scene and was doing a lot of 13-hour drives. That sucked. And so Ricardo was like, why don't you just figure out how to make beer like you like it, and then he'll take care of the rest. That was the plan.
So my name is Ricardo Petroni, and I started home brewing like 20 years ago when I was myself at MIT. It was through a mutual friend that he got me the first homebrew kit. I'm originally from Argentina, and Argentina, the beer is like not so interesting. So when I got here to Boston, it was like starting to get into the craft brewer in 97, I'm talking. And it was amazing to me. It was like, oh my God, this is so great. And so I got entangled into it. And then, for 20 years, I tried to keep up with it. I lived in Argentina again for, 10 or 12 of those. And that was harder. It was like very difficult to kind of smuggle things, hops and whatnot, because, they were not available. But I still keep at it. And then when the consulting business, which we met, it was getting boring to me. After 20 years of being an engineer, environmental engineer, working on sediment transport and whatnot. And so I was like, well, I want to do this, the beer. And I started kind of gathering a team. And then with Pete, I saw that his obsessiveness and research-oriented mind will be, the key for getting awesome recipes.
It's a blessing and a curse.
Yeah. And so that was kind of the driver. And I was like, gathering the team together and putting also, I have an MBA also, and kind of putting all the business mind to behind the project. And so I'm doing a little bit of this and that on the brewery.
Cool. So let's start with innovation. So 10 years ago in brewing, Brettanomyces was a dirty word. Now it's a buzzword. So let's talk about, I think each of you use Brett in your brewing. So let's talk about, first of all, what is Brettanomyces? It's a yeast. Now we know it's a wild yeast. Talk about a little bit how you use it.
So our program is quite interesting because we harvest a lot of Brettanomyces from, that naturally occurs in Queens. We found that we have very interesting strands of Brettanomyces that you find on fruit, specifically figs. So through our cool ship, we've harvested many strands of Brettanomyces. We culture them and use them a lot in many of our beers. So pretty much all of our Saisons, all of our Belgian-style ales, all have multiple strands of Brettanomyces that we use in those beers. We find that we get really interesting characteristics based on the different grain bills we have and different water profiles and different temperatures and different environments that the yeast are in. So it's part of our program that's really, really expanding. We have quite a few barrels now that are developing. We're about a year and a half, 2 years into our barrel program. So a lot of the spontaneous beers are really starting to develop. It's an exciting time, especially doing such a thing in Queens, which is kind of crazy.
So let's add, so you guys were the first brewery in New York State to have a cool ship, correct?
Right.
So talk a little bit about what a cool ship is and how you guys use it at the brewery.
So a cool ship is a large open vessel that is used to rapidly cool down the wort. That's what it's called before it's beer. So we come out of the brew house into this large open vessel that holds roughly 640 gallons. It's 20 barrels approximately. So we do a traditional turbid mash. We look for a really dextrinous wort. With a lot of a lot of long chain sugars and carbohydrates for the bacteria and yeast to consume during the long fermentation period. So we come into the cool ship hot, 210, about 208, and then we leave the wort in the cool ship overnight in a room that's under negative pressure. So we always pull air through the brewery into the cool ship room and out. This way we can control all the bacteria and yeast that are in that room. We don't want them to get out of that room and into the brewery. So we always hold the room under negative pressure. When we move the beer into the cool ship, we open up other ventilation system that pulls air from the outside and circulates. So we have 20, 30 exchanges a minute of air through the room. During that time, all the wild yeast and bacteria inoculate the wort that's in that cool ship. And it also cools it down. So we only do this during very specific temperatures. So we look to be in the 20s to the high 30s when we do this. This way we can rapidly cool down the wort in the cool ship. Then we go out straight directly into oak barrels, predominantly Chardonnay, and it goes for a long fermentation, anywhere from 1 to 3 years. So we're in year two right now, and we're seeing quite a development in the beers.
So I have to clarify, just because I know not all of you, how many of you are homebrewers or brewers out there? Okay, so, because I've been, so this podcast has been going for about 4 years. So what he means by that is this, you know, lots of dextrins and turbid mashes that he is, they are making their wort so that there's sugars left over after the regular Saccharomyces yeast eat, so that there's something for the wild yeast and bacteria to continue to eat and produce more aromas and flavors. Anyway, all right, Eric, let's talk about Brett.
Most of the Brett that we use is cultivated, meaning we source it from a lab. We've used quite a few different strains. We use it in a number of different ways. Most typically is 100% primary fermentation. I think a lot of breweries, well, maybe less and less as time goes on, are afraid of Brettanomyces. We tend to look at it as really just another yeast strain, like Saccharomyces would be, only it sticks around. It doesn't like to die very easily, so you just have to pay extra attention when you're using it for your beers and make sure that, you know, your processes are in line. But we find that in 100% primary fermentations, we get a lot more clean fruit, interesting spice tones. And we, you know, those beers you can turn around in a relatively short period of time. But in a secondary fermentation application, if we were to use Saccharomyces first and then rack the beer onto Brettanomyces for a long-term secondary, you can extract a lot more sort of, I guess you would call it barnyard funk characteristics, mousy, leathery. So there's a few different ways you can use it to achieve different results. You know, in quick fermentations, it plays really well with hops, at least some of them. And then if, you know, for barrels, for long-term stainless steel aging, you can really sort of eke out some really great, interesting, more rustic characteristics. So we try to use it for both sort of applications, I'd say.
Peter?
Yeah, I guess.
Or Ricardo?
We kind of do something similar to you guys. The spontaneous stuff is interesting, also terrifies me trying to open. So we're not doing any cool ship stuff at this point. But I sort of just tried to play with every Brett strain I could get my hands on. And we use it in similar ways as you do, like There and Back Again, which is on tap, the fruited version. One of my really good friends, Jason Rodriguez, I don't know if he used to be around here, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a Columbia microbiologist. He's a doctor. And he actually was actually going to work with Trillium, and then when he asked why weren't you going to work with Trillium, he said, "Well, I'm working on the AIDS vaccine." And so, what do you say to that? Like, okay, thank you for making us safe. So he isolated several Brett strains from this 2004 Cantillon Blaber bottle, and he's just been pulling these Brett strains and giving them to me to play with. And so we really liked the one for this, and so this is 100% Brett in the primary, and we found a certain parameter space that it just throws lots of tropical fruit, like you were saying, makes ethyl lactate, to be precise. Then we also have a lot of other Brett strains, for example, Casey's on draft two, and that is naturally carbonated, and the Brett is thrown in after fermentation. We find it gives a bit different ester profile when it's under pressure, which is sort of interesting. You just got to really be careful with your carbonation, because you can overshoot pretty easy, and then you get some seltzer bomb, which is gross, I've heard. So that's pretty much how we're doing it right now. I'm just trying to keep things a little on the quicker side versus barrels, just so we can open.
Yeah.
But eventually we'll get a...
But you guys are all using... I mean, you're using Brett in the primary as well.
Right, we do as well.
So let's move on to another topic entirely. So we got some questions from the audience. We have multiple questions about this illustrious New England IPA style. So you guys all make kick-ass IPAs. I've now have had all, you know, I've had multiple IPAs from all of you. Only one of yours because I just had it today. But New England IPA, Heather asks, is it a trend or the birth of a new style? What are your thoughts?
It's funny because I've been brewing these, I brewed these beers as a home brewer in my garage. I guess accidentally back then, but so yeah, I don't really think it's a trend. I think it's I think there's actually process that's imparting a lot of the flavors that you get in these beers. I hear some of the talk about how people refer to the beers. I agree with some of it. I don't agree with all of it. I think a lot of it. I'm just being frank. A lot of the you know, the appearance of the beer and the flavor profile in the beer in, from our brewery is all process. It's completely process. And I think that's what's unique about it. Do I think it's a trend? No, I think brewers have been brewing these beers like this for a very, very long time. I think we're just seeing different ingredients being used now in some of these beers that maybe weren't used in the late 90s or, you know, mid-2000s. Brewers are using a lot more wheat now. They're using a lot of flaked oats, less caramel malt, less crystal malt in the beers. So I think because of that, it's imparting different characteristics in the beer that maybe people weren't necessarily used to before. But for me, you know, brewing a lot of Belgian ales, there's a really clear transition between some of those grain bills. A lot of our grain bills and our hoppy beers are very similar to a lot of our Belgian ales, but you can see how the results are different because of the yeast and two, because we're using quite a bit of hops. But those characteristics that I like in Belgian ales, I try to carry over to some of these hoppy beers. So more of a fuller mouthfeel, but a dry beer with some maybe that wheat and some of those oats in the beer. And we find that when we use those ingredients, we are able to capture a lot of the hop oils from the hops, or we found in our brewery at least. So we find a lot of those hop oils are actually clinging to those proteins that are in the beer. Whether there's some scientific progress on that, I'm not sure. But we just know from our process, you know, what we get with the beers.
Anyone else want to talk about the New England IPA?
As far as style goes, I don't know if it'll ever be a recognized like BJCP style, but I think it'll always be a subset of IPA at least, or I think it's only going to expand from here. You know, you see it being, you know, catching some traction on the West Coast, and I think that we're only going to see more of that. And I think it's sort of a divisive kind of beer because some people find it really, you know, hideous, and some people, you know, just like horrified by what it looks like. And I think that there's certain great ways to achieve that haze where it contributes to the beer, and then you can sort of pass a tipping point where that haze becomes, you know, murky and detracts from the beer. And I think that, like you were saying, process is a huge part of it. Like if that's all yeast in your glass that makes your IPA hazy, then it's not going to taste good. I think that there's certain tricks to doing it, and I think that it's pretty interesting. And I think the science will start to follow as far as you're talking about proteins, you know, starches and hop oils glomming together and timing of dry hopping and all that. There's definitely a lot of work put into making beers this way. It's not just, you know, murky homebrew. So, I mean, I'd say I'm into it. If the beers have more hop intensity and if that's what people are looking for, then I think that's a great thing. And anytime a new style develops, I'm usually behind it. I like them, pretty much all styles. So.
Yeah, I don't think it's a trend at all. I mean, personally, it's what I like to drink, so I know I'm going to keep making it because I think it's a better tasting beer. It's more aromatic. And like these guys refer to, the process that you can really pull out of that juice up, but you can also get some real bad flavors too. A lot of astringency from polyphenols and whatnot. So the trick is, how do you get the good stuff and leave the bad stuff behind? Unless you get that real throat burn. So just got to figure out how to do it right. but I think it's here to stay. And I would say, you know, it's an IPA. Yeah. It's just looks different. It's just IPA.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the problem with the definitions of what an IPA was. An IPA was a beer kind of with a lot of hops. That was kind of the definition. At the beginning, it was a lot of hops in the boil, so it was like very bitter and very, you know. And that was it. This is not bitter anymore in that sense. I mean, it still has some bitterness to it, but it's like smoother, it's softer, it's round, it's juicier. So in that sense, it's like, you know, I don't know exactly how to call it, but you know, it's here to stay. It's a new style of things that people like, and I actually sometimes like something like a West Coast on your face IPA, because I mean sometimes I want that, you know, like, and so it's a kind of a different thing to drink. What we decided to do though is more this, I would say, New England style. That's what we do
because it tastes better.
One advantage I think of being able to serve these super fresh, hoppy beers is that you can all take, you know, serve them out of your tasting room, or, you know, they're not going very far. That you're.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
Because I completely agree. The West Coast style can survive a lot longer, and that was the original intention of the hoppy beers. The hoppy beers were for, you know, to India and all the travel, and then get there fresh. And you know, these kind of beers, they cannot sustain more than 2 months, and it can start fading. Like a lot less than that even. So the freshness has to do with the new trend of people actually coming to the place instead of beer going to them, and so there is more locality to it, and that is a new trend here. It has to do with all the kind of the growth of a smaller brewery. So what we see now is that it's going kind of back to the pre-prohibition time where, you know, each town will have the brewery, you know, and then. Everybody will drink there because, I mean, it didn't make any sense to actually kind of get into the horse and then get the beer someplace else. And so... yeah. So, anyway, I think, you know, that trend also has to do with this locality that the beer has, that you can drink it fresh. I mean, I don't see how you can get really more than regional, maybe, and get this freshness of beer, you know, around. I mean, like the beer traveling to Oregon, it's not reaching fine, you know, like.
Yep. So I think another thing I think about 10 years ago is everybody had a flagship beer, right? That's no longer the case. Now, as a lot of craft breweries have maybe flagship flavors. So on that same line, Chris asked, how do you distinguish yourselves in an increasingly cluttered craft beer marketplace? Do you have flagship flavors?
Make exceptionally good beer.
Second that.
Yes.
That was easy.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, we've recently gotten some recognition for many of our hoppy beers, but believe it or not, Arden Core, which is our farmhouse saison, keeps the lights on the brewery. We brew a lot of that beer. And you know, that beer appeals to a lot of people. You know, we've brought that beer to the dinner table at fine dining restaurants. We brought that beer to craft beer bars, and it really appeals to a wide audience of people. It's a, you know, dry, quenching beer, nice citrus notes. So we like to call it our flagship beer because essentially it is. It's what we brew the most of. It's what we sell the most of. But we love brewing all beers. We don't want to get bored just brewing one style all the time. Fortunately for our brewery, we brew a lot of different styles. We opened the brewery brewing all Belgian ales, just basically because I didn't have the hops. So I couldn't brew hobby beer. And that's what I love. That's what the brew is founded on. I just love the intricacies of those beers and the subtleties of those beers. I would love to have, you know, 4 or 5 styles that we brewed and brought to market all the time. And I think the brewery is developing that at the moment. But we also brew a lot of new styles as well to keep things interesting and exciting.
Either one. You guys can take it.
Yeah, I will agree with that. I think, you know, the success of as more breweries pop up, good beer is key. Knowing what you're doing, knowing how people are drinking the beer, you know, where to drink it, and understanding. Also having fun with the styles. I think, you know, that is also keeping it fresh, which is what people want also. So we also brew several different things that we already haven't. We've been open for 4 months only, and we have like 7 different beers already. And so we do have like breadth of things from sour beers to farmhouses to IPAs. And so we're trying to have like different things that we like to drink. And what Peter said at the beginning, it was like I was tired of driving to Vermont, and you know, like it's like I want to make beer that I want to drink, and that's basically it. We're making the beer that we want to drink.
You know, I wouldn't say we're going for a flagship beer, but the style we want to do is sort of balancing lots of flavor, but also keeping it really drinkable. And that's kind of a common trait we want in all our beers, that, you know, some beers you have, and some are only meant to have a glass, but if someone like has a Photon, which actually was a very challenging beer to make with such low ABV, and then wants another one, that's the big compliment to me. It's like, oh, let me get another one. It's like, wow, it'd be great. So you like the flavor, but you want more. It doesn't build and creep on your palate and kind of get you, I guess they call it palate fatigue. So it's sort of balancing drinkability with big flavors, sort of what we're going for in general. So it's sort of like our flagship.
It's interesting that, yeah, that's the flagship concept. And then it's interesting that we're trying to do that. But it's also interesting that Photon, the Pale Ale was one of the most challenging beers to make. Because yep. It's really hard to make a low ABV beer that actually has a lot of flavor.
Although thankfully many breweries are doing it very well. That's one of my favorite things to drink is low alcohol beers.
Do you love craft beer? The diversity of styles and flavors? The stories of small brewery businesses and the communities behind today's craft beer movement? If so, you'll love craftbeer.com, published by the Brewers Association. Whether you tasted your first craft beer 30 years ago or just caught the bug last week, craftbeer.com is the number one destination for beer education, news, and recipes. Looking for a local brewery? Use the internet's most robust brewery finder to discover your new favorite place. Want to get geeky about your favorite beer style or find the perfect pairing for dinner? Craftbeer.com is the leading authority and can help. Celebrate the best of American beer. Visit craftbeer.com today.
I'm going to move to hops. So we have quite a few hop questions. So Brian asked, so many great hops being used. What's a great one we haven't seen or drank yet? So either one, maybe like a new hop that you've just started using or one that you look forward to using more.
Calista is a new hop that we're going to start working with. It's a really interesting German hop. It has a lot of the stone fruit notes, peach, you know, aromatics. So we're going to start using that. It's a new hop to come on. Ariana is another German hop that's also similar to Calista, but we're going to start using. We're looking forward to that. I brewed old school hops.
But that's a cool thing, right? Yeah. That's another thing we're seeing. So some of these West Coast hops are very difficult to get for new brewers because these breweries contract for hops years ahead of time. So if you're a newer brewery that's opening, maybe not as big as some of the established breweries, you have a hard time getting hop contracts, right? So you can't get some of these really hot, hip hops that are out there. And that's the cool thing, I think, is that we're seeing breweries like LIC Beer Project do new things with old hops, and that's super cool. So, yeah, either old or new, what's a fun hop that you're either having fun with or you're looking forward to using?
I'll second Ariana. We just started using that hop. At least in one beer, we brewed a Pilsner with it, and I've just, you know, smelled and rubbed the hop and really think it's going to be a great new German sort of... A lot of the hops coming out of Germany have noble roots, so there's sort of an element of classic herbal noble character, but then they're pushing a lot more fruit and more contemporary characteristics, so I think Calista and Ariana are really cool new hops to look out for. And I'll also throw in Denali, which... you know, it's relatively new. We were just brewing with it this week. I'm a big fan. A lot of honeyed tropical fruit kind of characteristics. So that's another fun one to look out for.
I actually don't know the name of it. It's like B71643 or something like that. But it's got a really nice kind of honeydew, mandarin orange kind of characteristic too, which I think would be fun. That our fractal series we have in one on tap is just two row and one and a hop. And so that's sort of how we get to explore what these hops are doing and how they interact with our ale strains, etc. So that would be good. We're going to get some Siegel Ranch Cascade, which I've never used before, but I heard it's really good, so I'm excited to check that out.
Super Cascade.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to get some.
High old Cascade. And we contracted our hops 3 years ago. That's why we have them now.
Yes.
So fractal citrus fossil body decision we made 3 years ago.
That's something, though, that I went to hop school a couple years ago, and I didn't really understand the full, you know, how hop contracts work. So everybody wants, you know, everybody has their favorite hop, Mosaic or Galaxy or whatever, and just know that, you know, your favorite brewery might not be able to get it. I think that's cool, though, because like you guys talked about, you're using hops that are available and that are really interesting and fun, but have maybe been overlooked, and right. You're able to do really cool stuff with them, so... Props.
And the oldies are goodies. I mean, like, Vulgar is CTZ, Simcoe, and Chinook. It's not anything.
Right, like I mentioned earlier, it's really process. You know, it's how you use these hops. And you'd be surprised. Like many of our hoppy beers are, almost all our hoppy beers have Cascade in them in some way or another. That's like probably one of my favorite hops.
Any beer. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so Kim asks, what has been your biggest learning experience or mistake in brewing?
My biggest mistake was opening up a brewery. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm just... That's being super negative. I actually...
I kind of agree, but...
I came from the different side of the brewing industry, so it's quite interesting to now be on the production side when I did a lot of build-out and construction work for breweries. I could walk away and go to the next cool place and build something. But I would say my biggest learning experience with the brewery is really not capturing what our retail following was going to be and how many people are actually going to be on-premise at our brewery. And how many people are going to want to come to our brewery and spend their weekends there or their day off there and hang out with us and drink beer. I wasn't really prepared for that. So when I built the brewery, I built a production facility, and I kind of took my eyes off that quite a bit. So that's one of the biggest things that I, going back, I probably learned from was that people want to hang out. You know, people want to come and hang out and drink your beer and have fun and bring their dogs and their kids and get bent or not.
So, how about you, Eric?
So that was probably one of my biggest learning experiences.
I'll talk about a specific beer. Early on, we brewed an English bitter, and it was all these crazy British specialty malts and... West Yorkshire yeast, which is really sort of gamey, like really, really Englishy yeast, and then we threw in a bunch of Nelson's oven, and it didn't. The flavors did not work at all. The beer, wasn't technically flawed. It tasted like dog food. It was like, or like the way dog food smells, sort of like that, like raisiny. Yeah, exactly. I don't eat that much dog food. So we're like, what do we do with this? Like, it's the beer is fine. It's not, you know, there's nothing wrong. It just tastes really weird. Like, so we had friends of ours distill it down. They were happy to take all 12 kegs and small batch. Our brewery is pretty small. We only do 12 kegs at a time. So they distilled it all into 5 gallons of, I guess, beer schnapps is what you would call it. And it was really, it was great stuff. And then they had it in a carboy, and somebody knocked the carboy over with a hose, and that was the end of it. But so we have like a 1 ounce sample left over. It tastes great, it smells great, but it almost went to better use.
I guess for me, probably the biggest mistake I had was estimating my amount of time this would take and then trying to have a full-time serious job at the same time as trying to open the brewery. That's proved challenging. About mistakes, I would actually encourage mistakes, that if we're not dumping something, that means we're not doing something interesting enough. And some of the best flavors I've pulled from different yeast strains or different hopping processes have been sort of accidents. And it was just, holy shit, like, what happened here? This is amazing. And that's not what I thought was going to happen, but, you know, experiment, make mistakes. That's sort of my advice.
Yeah, I think we made a lot of mistakes. Most of them were controlled. and, like, yeah, we kind of expected mistakes. Some of them were painful. I mean, some of them were having, like, generating problems in the construction facility. I mean, we built up all the building and everything in last year, and there was a lot of things that we didn't know about, you know, and you make mistakes about timing. I think probably biggest mistake is timing, you know, I would say. You know, there is no way you can, everything, you know, like, nothing goes faster than you expect. Everything delays. So this cumulative effect of that delay gets you, like, 7 months later. And that what happened to us. We were hoping to open by April 2016, and we finally got like kind of something, you know. And it was like equipment, people, the construction thing, errors on our side, things that went wrong. So that is tough. I mean, and if you don't have a very good backup plan for that, it can destroy your business. And at the end of the day, this is very fun, but it's at the same time as business, so you need to So it was challenging. That was a challenge.
So that brings to our next question. We have time for a couple more. Kirsten asks, in what ways are you planning sustainable growth for your business? Have you planned that far ahead? I mean, you know, all three of you are relatively, you know, recent breweries in the scene, but have you thought that far ahead?
I really do have ideas. I don't think I have, like, a very definite idea. It's flexible in my head. However, that is my job, as, like, he was pointing out. And I do have, like at least three or different plans that I'm already working on at business plan level on understanding how we can expand if this goes well. We do have, like, some expansion inside the building that we already have. But also we have ideas of expansions. This kind of grows more than that. Sustainable growth is it's important. I would say today has to do with this business model where you have people. You have people coming to your place. That business model is the one that sustains growth. Really, you know, once you spread too much, it's a volume situation, and then when you're in the volume situation, it's a completely different kind of game. So right now we're trying not to get into the volume, but trying to get small quantity or relatively small quantity. With high quality beer and available in certain select places, and that is kind of the business model we have. The change into the volume model, I don't think we're gonna get to that in 5 years, and probably we won't go there. To be honest, I mean, like, we prefer to have that kind of a small set. So I will grow as long as we can on having this connection to what we're doing and to the people, and not get just some volume stuff that is, you know, not having the quality we want.
Yeah, I think one of the keys is just to not be greedy. I see some of these expansions that are happening, and it's not sustainable. You know, the breweries can't exponentially expand forever when the beer drinkers are really not exponentially expanding with them, especially at the expense of quality. You know, I think it's better to sort of stay smaller and do more interesting stuff, and that should hopefully...
Yeah, volume should be balanced with the kind of the growth of your consumer base. You know, it shouldn't be the other way around.
I guess my kind of vision of the future in some sense, and this is a terrible pun, but it's sort of like a local equilibrium with your community. And yeah, there's going to be cross-pollination. Get it? But, like, I don't know there's going to be, like, people driving 13 hours like I did and standing in line for 5 hours to get one bottle of beer. I don't see that as sustainable, to be honest. I mean, I'm still going to go to the farm stuff a lot, but...
It's not going to keep your lights on. So let me ask, what other styles? So you've kind of talked a little bit about what you'd like to drink and what that's what you're making, but what other styles or breweries get you excited right now?
What other styles?
Yeah. that you just like to drink outside of your own beer?
Oh, I like to drink a lot of stouts and porters.
LIC gift packages, thank you for that, Dan.
Pilsners. We thought you drink a lot of
Pilsners.
Pilsners, Kolsch.
Second Pilsners.
Helles Lagers, Vienna Lagers, Weissbier. Those kinds of stuff.
This is the end of beer week. These guys have been drinking for like 8 days straight.
Dude, I was just telling everyone that like I'm not drinking for 4 weeks after that. Then I realized I'm like traveling, like I have like 3 trips planned in the next like 6 weeks. So I guess that's not happening. But yeah, I like to drink Pilsners. I like to drink German Weiss beers. When I'm at home, it's usually what I drink.
I totally agree with all the German light German lagers. What happened?
11%.
Maybe I'm getting old, but I feel like everybody has that sort of curve. You know, you start off and you're in love with IPAs, and then you love double IPAs and barrel aged stouts, and then you realize that you just want a nice beer that with some nuance that you can sip on and not have to think about, or you can think about it as much as you want, but you can drink a bunch of it because it's not strong. So maybe I think I'm just at that point. Small British beers, you know, anyone? No?
ESB.
No. You have to conserve calories and sobriety. There are definitely limited quantities you can handle. So the lighter stuff. My girlfriend's from Austin, Texas, so I drink a lot of Jester King. Love the spontaneous fermented stuff. Terrified to bring to the brewery, but love to drink. Maybe one day.
That would be a tough sales pitch to you.
Yeah. Dynamic. Sorry, you can see the dynamics here.
So I know that The Well had a panel last weekend talking about collaboration. Some of you have done collaborations. Let's talk about, have you done collaborations and how do you feel about them? If you have one coming up.
Yeah, we haven't done many collaborations. We don't like to just collaborate people for the sense of collaborating. I know it gets people excited, and that's cool, but I really don't care about those things. Don't excite those things. Don't excite me.
Tell us how you really feel.
Dude, I'm not in this business to, you know, to blow smoke on people's asses. I've done that already. So I like to collaborate with people that are cool, you know, people I can vibe with, people I can hang out with, have a good time, and you know, do something exciting, do something fun and interesting that I wouldn't do at my brewery. And that's what when we collaborate with people, that's really what we're after. We're after, you know, we build friendships before we collaborate with people. Anybody we've made beer with, we're friends with those people, you know, we know those people personally, and that's super important to me. You know, I wouldn't go and eat dinner at somebody's house I didn't know just because they make good food. I want to be their friend. You know, I want to hang out with people. I want to build relationships. So that's really what collaborating for us is about. I think it's really cool, you know, to get into other people's breweries and see how they do things and kind of, you know, kick off each other about how your process is and how you make your beers and how you handle your beers, how you transfer your beers, how you package your beers. So everybody does things a little bit differently, and I think it's super cool to do that with friends instead of strangers. So that's how I feel about collaborating.
Sounds good.
Anybody else want to chime in?
That was very educational for me because we've never done one. So, but that makes a lot of sense. We're going to open the tap room eventually and then talk about collaboration.
We've done a couple, not a lot, but it's sort of a funny situation because there's always the host brewery, and then there's the brewery that's, you know, coming to brew with you. So there's always like the brew staff of the host brewery taking care of the brew day, and then there's, you know, the brewery that's coming to work with you, and they have their opinions. But it's almost like I'm going to hang out while you guys brew, right? I'll throw in my opinion here and there, and it's not always that way, but. And I think there's a lot of ways to go about it. And I sort of like when I like when collaborations are at both breweries. So you see one version of the beer here, and then you see the other version of the beer that's been brewed in the opposite direction. So then it's a little bit more of an equal sort of I don't know, experience for both breweries, and it's a little bit more fair that way. But yeah, I mean, I think they're good. I don't think that it always produces the best beer because there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen. But I don't know, it can be fun. It can be kind of laid back and, you know, a good afternoon.
I'm going to ask a tricky question. So canning. So again, 10 years ago, cans were only for macros. Now cans, I, you know, personally seek out cans. So I know that you guys have canned. I don't know if you have canned yet or if you're thinking about it.
We have a line, but we haven't canned it.
Ooh, you have a line.
We have a canning line that we haven't used yet.
So let's talk about your experience with canning and what struggles you've faced and kind of your overall takeaway.
I really want to stay positive during this whole thing.
We want to hear the truth, Dan.
Canning is quite the challenge. It's been the challenge for us. We super, super love our beer. The way we handle our beer, we move our beer from the brew house to the fermenter, from the fermenter to the bright tank, and into package. Every single aspect of that is documented, it's tracked, and we are on top of it. So to see when things break down in the package is really, really upsetting to me. It's something that really, really bothers me quite a bit. There are high levels of dissolved oxygen in the beers based on how they're being handled and packaged. It's a tough thing. It's really tough. I spent a lot of time talking to the guys over at Firestone Ballast Point about how they package their beers. I'm going to be traveling out there hopefully this summer, Tom, and to spend some time with them about how they're packaging their beers, because they're doing it right. Their beers are on the shelves. You know, you can buy a Pivo Pils 3-4 months old, and the beer's not brown. The beer's not oxidized. The beer's good. So they're doing things that some of these mobile canners maybe aren't doing. We just invested in a canning line, so we're going to take the responsibility upon ourselves to package our beers. We'll be putting that online this summer. So we'll be able to take all that responsibility ourselves. And, you know, investing in the right equipment, being able to measure DO levels with, you know, different types of equipment and stuff is super important. But, yeah, it's quite the challenge.
I would say that, yeah, the canning line, the challenge of the DO is kind of why we made the decision early on investing in a canning line, to try to kind of get more of an ownership of what's going on with the canning, because I agree. I mean, for the hoppy beers we're making, they disintegrate in 5 days. I mean, it's amazing how fast they go to waste if they have the wrong dissolved oxygen in the can. So that's why I do think that, you know, we have like a, you know, in the summer we're thinking also on getting into the canning line process and getting it, learning how to actually do it. Equipment is expensive, but I think it's worth it for the experience to be as good as it can be for the customer.
We were very fortunate early on where John and Jen Kimmick of Alchemist, who we kind of became friends with, gave us some pointers, and they're like, just get a canning line. Just don't mess around with the people. And I've been talking to Damon about splitting a DO probe, just so you know.
Yeah, so a good DO meter is probably about $30,000. That's quite the investment for a small brewery.
Yeah.
But should be a sharing.
Right. Yeah. Like, just optimize your equipment and pass it on. Yeah. You don't need to measure it all the time.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm going to wrap things up, but I would love for you guys to talk about where your tasting room, hours, sure, where you are, and then best place to find out what you're doing on social media.
So Instagram is, we're pretty active on Instagram. We like to get everybody information through there. Our brewery is located in Queens in Long Island City, 23rd Street between 39th and 40th Avenue. We're a few blocks from Queensboro Plaza. We're also near the F train there. And we are open Wednesday through Sunday. Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays at 4. And then on the weekends we open at noon or 1. One. I told you earlier how I underestimated the on-premise, the tap room. Yeah, so, you know, come by, hang out, have a beer. It's a pretty cool vibe. We like to have bands and stuff on the weekends. We're building in a food concept at the moment, so we're going to have some, you know, street fair there, hopefully by the summertime. And that's our little project.
We're at 7 North 15th Street in Greenpoint, but right on the border of Williamsburg, so East River right there. We're open 5 to midnight, Monday through Thursday, and then 12 to midnight, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Full kitchen, wine, liquor, whatever you need. 16 taps.
Whatever you need.
Other things, just come in the bag, have the dollar sign on it.
And what's your best social media?
That would be probably Instagram, if not the website, I would say.
We are not hopefully not open yet, but hopefully to open this March, so in a couple of weeks. So the tap room, and we're going to have tap room and restaurant. Tap room will be available for growlers and whatnot, and we're going to have the restaurant and everything open for only 7 days a week. But the tap room, I mean, the growler filling will be like limited hours, and we'll communicate that through Facebook mostly, and we also communicate through Instagram and Twitter. That's about it.
Cool. Well, thank you guys so much. I hope you enjoyed the panel, and I think these guys are sticking around a little bit. I didn't get to every question, and some of you might have very personal questions, so hopefully you get the chance to ask them. Thanks again.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.